This is the Kathmandu Guest House in Nepal, September 18th, a Sunday, 2005. And it's a great pleasure for me to have a chance to talk with Michael Allen, who I just met the other day for the first time, and to ask him a few questions about his background, his life, and his practice of anthropology. Michael, if I may begin, could you tell me when you were born and where you were born, and into what family?
I was born into a rather rare species of humanity these days, I suppose, in 1928, into an Anglo-Irish family, which was then, I suppose, only about 5% of the population. I gather it's now less than two. And I suppose the most thing I can, but the thing I remember most vividly about growing up in Ireland was the Protestantized side of it. And well, I went to Protestant schools. They were all boarding schools, absolute nightmares. And a sense of mysterious difference to the rest of the Irish population, that they were as much other as if they were in Africa almost, for that degree of closure, the Anglo-Irish community I lived in. I went to Trinity College Dublin, as virtually all Protestant Irish did. It was then, there were no Catholics in Trinity. Not through any Protestant prohibition, but the Archbishop required dispensation from Rome for a Catholic to go there. So that was a further reinforcement of the Protestant world that I was very much saturated. Not that I was in the least, by the age of 20, I think I had ceased to believe at all in Protestantism. I found it even repulsive. And very rapidly became, a somewhat rabid atheist at that stage. And I studied philosophy. It was called Mental and Moral Science at Trinity. And fortunately managed to get a first-class degree of 4 years of philosophy that was a mixture, really, of psychology, logic, and metaphysics. But never got beyond Hegel. And I did not like Hegel. Luckily, I seem to be able to understand it. Though subsequently, I've been fascinated with going back to Hegel at times, relating it to my training as an anthropologist, his view of the whole social process or whatever, politicization of it. I found it very frequently very insightful. But with a first-class honours degree in mental and moral science from Trinity College Dublin then, there are about two things you could do. You become a Church of Ireland clergyman, which is quite clearly what I've said. That was not a track I was going down. Or I could apply for one or two Protestant firms, Guinness being the cardinal one. So I wound up a trainee brewer in Guinness's. 3 years of nightmare life, Park Royal in London, shortly after the war. Long queues for meat, smog everywhere. British class system. The whole thing filled me with complete, only one thing, waiting for the moment I could get out of it. So it was saving money from a tiny salary until a wonderful chance came. A fellow Irishman I'd known at school, who was an extreme adventurer, still is in fact, and he writes travel books, got a job teaching English at the Royal Military Academy in Kabul, and said to Clarion Call, "Michael, come, we will have great adventures."
What was his name?
Peter Somerville Large.
Sure, know his books.
So I went out. Resigned from Guinness and went out and joined them, and we had indeed many intriguing adventures, mainly in Badakhshan, and mainly trying to get out of Afghanistan. We had absolutely ludicrous ambitions. We wanted to enter into Russian Central Asia, to cross the whole of Russia into Siberia, walk, you might all say, metaphorically barefoot across the Bering Straits, arrive in America, become famous and retire as Irish gents. Luckily, we were entirely impeded all along the Himalayas in any of these ambitions. But getting to anthropology, my first hint, there was no such thing as anthropology in Ireland then, there isn't even very much now apart from Northern Ireland and at Maynooth. But there was none at all then. I suppose the word meant to me was measuring skulls or something, the usual public image at that time of anthropology. I met some Swedish archaeologists and linguists working at Bamiyan, a place, of course, you know, was destroyed. And what they were doing somewhat intrigued me, but then we moved down into Peshawar, to Swat, We went up to Hunza. And in Peshawar, before going up to Hunza, I met Frederick Bath, who was taking a break from his work. And at the time I was suffering hepatitis, and the wretched man said, the best thing's whiskey. Which, well, somehow or other, he was right. We'd had quite a number of whiskies, and 3 weeks later I'd well recovered. But he talked to me over those whiskies intensely of what he was doing, and I thought, this indeed, if I can ever be an anthropologist, what I've been groping towards, to live amongst people who, as my own experience in Ireland, the Catholics were mysterious, not easy to understand why they did what they did, seemed to me an utterly fascinating task. And lo and behold, it was a profession. There's a chance you might even earn the old penny in it. That stuck in my head with further adventures in the Himalayas. And I came to Nepal for the first time then. We spent about 4 months with my friend Nuchi Bahadur, who was just starting a Nandakuti school with Amrita Nanda. And we had adventures with the most decrepit kind after a big game down at Kailali Kanchanpur. Some Ranas misorganized, luckily, so there's no chance of hitting anything. And on to Bhutan, we also penetrated about halfway up into Bhutan without permits and were arrested and were dealt with by the Indian authorities in a very civil manner as just lunatic young Irishmen. And eventually got to Australia and spent about 9 months working in a gold mine there, saving up money, thinking maybe I'd go to what I had learned from Bath would be one of the meccas of anthropology, Chicago, and Chicago means something to an Irishman. But when I got to Sydney and realized that all that money I'd saved 9 months in this gold mine had been spent getting to Chicago, I thought Sydney looked like, you know, it looked like a city. I'd been down in the middle of the desert for 9 months. I couldn't imagine Australia had such a place at all. Might have a university. And I'd arrived at Central Railway and got directed. It was just really a short walk from Central Railway. And of course there it was, a classically a Scottish type university with this quadrangle and all the rest of it. And anthropology department, the next thing I was in Professor Elkin's office, who was the doyen of Australian anthropology at the time, his speciality Australian Aborigines. And I told him, you know, that I had this degree, is there any way I could become an anthropologist? And he said, have you got a private income? So I said, sorry, no, I don't have a private. Well, there's only 5 of us in Australia, and none of us are very old yet. I don't think there'll ever be any more or less.
What year was that?
That was 1956. It was the only department, a small nucleus of researchers that had begun under Nadell at the ANU about the same.
In Canberra,
a couple of years earlier, but that was purely at a level that I wasn't at yet, PhD research. He said, you can enroll here as an MA qualifying student and just do the anthropology units of a BA and see what happens. And if you do well, then maybe we can get some small research funds for you to do an MA. So I did that, and luckily it all worked pretty well. In fact, the thesis I wrote, which is a comparative study of male initiations in Melanesia, later on, about 10 years later, I published it, and it's probably the book's given me greater fame than any other one.
Well, just to, you've given a wonderful overview, actually, of the various steps that brought you to Australia and en route, of course, across Central Asia and Himalayas. But to zero in and maybe rewind a little,
a bit more
focus on your early years, it's quite a step that you took with Peter Somerville Lodge to risk Central Asia and the Himalayas like that. Was there anything in your upbringing, your childhood, that you think gave you a flavour for something grander than Guinness and local aspirations?
Oh, yes. I mean, at school, I was hopeless at school, and I was already getting deaf then, so I was always sitting at the back of the class, and I was always reading literature, and that certainly is hugely stern, all kinds of literature. But I remember one day I got hold of Sven Hayden, and that really excited me, that romantic notion of exploration of unexplored places by Europeans. Which now, of course, I see in a very different light, but it certainly excited my imagination very much then. I think it was that kind of thing. It was private reading, and also the Anglo-Irish, by tradition in the previous generation, they ran the British Empire virtually, all helped to. They were always out in Africa or in India in the Indian Civil Service or whatever. So the houses that I knew in Arles were full of Tibetan materials, you know, wonderful tankers and prayer wheels and odd objects from various parts of Africa that have been dragged back. And the Irish Museum too was full of magnificent stuff, especially cooked stuff from the Pacific.
Was this true of your family also? Was there some...
Not really. No, my family was much more ordinary middle class, living just on the edge of Dublin. My father was a stockbroker, the most useless stockbroker that ever was. He was really a watch tinkerer or something like that. He was a train engineer and had the misfortune, you might say, to marry the daughter of a failed stockbroker. So no, there was not in my family, but in many of the families of friends that I made at school, lived in these big crumbling country Irish estates with this kind of stuff, and with traditions of exploration, of foreign places, of curiosity, and the diversity of the world. And that was certainly, during my teens especially, becoming more and more important.
And were your family and friends around you supportive of your departure from London into the unknown, essentially? Or was that a battle as well?
Not a battle, but great puzzlement, a huge anxiety. And that anxiety was massively compounded when I resigned. I went over back to Ireland and spent about 3 or 4 weeks sort of organising things, farewelling my family. The final day came was to get the boat from Holyhead across to Liverpool, and then the boat to Karachi, which I got left from Liverpool, and there was only a few hours in Liverpool between one and the other. Then there was the usual Irish weeping and wailing at Dunleary Pier. My mother was sort of distraught. So I got, that was finally over, grabbed a pint of Guinness. After about half an hour, there was a call that I was wanted on which must be a telephone, some form of communication anyway, on the boat. It was my mother. They'd gone back home and they knew, I kept a tin box on the table that had all, everything, my passport, money, documents, tickets, the whole lot were there on it. Of course, she went into complete panic, what to do. And she recovered from a panic very quickly. She said, Mike, I have a friend in Aer Lingus. Maybe he can get a pilot to fly it over in the morning. I think the boat got in about 7 or 8 in the morning, and the other boat was going off at about midday or 1 o'clock. I remember getting a taxi out to the airport, watching planes coming in. In came the Aer Lingus, and all the passengers got off, and suddenly it was an old-fashioned plane, cockpit opened, and the pilot got out. I could see the sun shining on that. No. Anyway, I got it. So that course obviously accentuated my family's anxiety. How on earth can this son of ours, you know, manage what he's, these ludicrous plans? But they never attempted to stop me at all. No.
What about brothers and sisters? Did you come from a large Irish family?
They were very much younger. My sister was a few years younger, but she was already married. I don't think she had much grasp of what I was about at all, really. Married a North of Ireland bloke who went into Marks and Spencer's, and I'm afraid she disappeared into another kind of world altogether. Though later on we've become close. My brother was still a schoolboy, he's 11 years younger. I subsequently learnt that it obviously greatly affected. He became a teacher of Latin first Ireland, then England, and it became redundant. Hardly a wonder his Latin disappeared at about the age of 55. And then he suddenly started becoming, and he still is, a physical explorer. He leads expeditions up and down the Himalayas and the Andes, and God knows what else, at the age of 65. So, and I know for certain that there was something seething there when he was young about all these reports coming back from me and my adventures while he was teaching Latin. So it obviously had some impact on him.
You describe very well this the possibility of this travel and the possibility of just turning up in a place like Sydney, walking in, meeting a professor and saying, well, may I study? Mm. One of the things, of course, that's happened in the discipline of anthropology since that time is the institutionalization of it, of course, that this kind of possibility is rarely there anymore. Do you see that the students that you've taught have come through very different paths to the discipline?
Very different. Many of them still share some of, I suppose you could say, the romantic component, the romantic in the sense of a fascination with the other, but an increasing capacity to see the other in themselves. And of course, another major restriction in limiting the ambitions of many PhD students just starting are now the terms of scholarship too. That they're so miserable, they're so short, especially if you're going into an area where very little preliminary language learning can be carried out. That seriously limits possibilities. I'd say now in Sydney University, 2/3 of the students are working in Australia, either in exotic communities in Australia or on some central feature of modern contemporary Australian society.
Mm. I know, of course, your work through Nepal, but you hinted just before we started the interview that actually not only is that not your whole portfolio, but it's not even the work for which you've become most renowned. Perhaps you could also give a little overview of the various places you've worked and the periods that you worked there and what drew you to those places.
Well, so when I finished that MA qualifying at Sydney, John Barnes had arrived during the last year of when I was doing fourth year honours, in fact, and we got on very well together, and he was very impressed, seemingly, with my thesis, and he then immediately moved up to the chair at the ANU, and he took me and another student up as his first PhD students to the ANU, so there I was at the ANU, and at that time, though there was no prohibition against where you worked, it was nobody knew anything about anywhere else other than the Pacific, John Barnes. But John Barnes was not going to break that tradition either. He didn't want to send people off to Africa, as far as I can see. He immediately tried to acquaint himself with Papua New Guinea because of Nadel's interest. And the first things he wrote were on I think, the Mungan kinship system in Australia, on the average, though he never did any research there. So he wasn't going to change that policy, a primary focus on the Pacific, Australia and surrounding Pacific area. And at the time, just about the time I arrived at the ANU, the British administration in the condominium of the New Hebrides, at that stage was still jointly administered by Britain and France, subsequently became Sir John Rennie, he'd done honours in anthropology at Oxford and was very much, in some ways, a frustrated anthropologist, and was very keen to further anthropological research in Vanuatu. There'd been nothing done since Layard and Deakin Layard in 1910, sort of the same time as Malinowski, and Deakin in the 1930s. And then Deakin died before he ever got a job in academia. So, say, Rennie was very keen to have more research done, and he made a proposal to the ANU to share the expenses of research in Vanuatu. And in my comparative work on Melanesian secret male societies, the most classic area was Northern New Hebrides. So I was immediately fascinated when there seemed to be money and there was a possibility of doing research there, so off I went. So that's why I went to work there. Though I must say, if there had been similar possibilities of working right here in Nepal, because I really have been utterly, totally fascinated by, and I had a fairly long period here, about 4 or 5 months, and I would have come here like a shot. But South Asia, I mean, John was Africa, but there was absolutely no knowledge of South Asia at all. In the anthropological field, at the ANU, Basham had just arrived, but he had only just arrived. I went to work in Vanuatu. The area I went to work in was supposedly full of all these cults, and all I found were people going to church all the time and cracking open coconuts, which posed its own, I know, was indeed very interesting, but not at all it didn't touch that romantic side, and also the intellectual interest in extreme forms of masculinity, and that has always intrigued me. I'm sure relates to the gender structured life I had in Ireland.
Boarding
schools, all male,
yes.
And pretty, you know, very much modelled on the English. So slightly softer, perhaps, in the English, being Irish, but even Anglo-Irish, but still very much, you know, there was bullying, hierarchy, secrecy. We had our own little cults around smoking and drinking and whatever up in bushes in the mountains. That fascinated me. And then about the other third of my life was family life, which was almost completely, my father, very gentle, retiring sort of man. He didn't figure very largely, of course, absent fathers, I mean, in the office as well. There was sister, mother, and our whole flock of female cousins that constituted this domestic life, which was like heaven. It was full of warmth, fun, later on some sensuality. I had a very acute sense of two worlds, male and female. So all of my work ever since has been really around gender. First of all the male stuff, and then beginning in Nepal, straight into, well, not straight, after preliminary work on the basics of Newar Baha structure, Newar Buddhism, I was immediately attracted by, well, two things, of course, the Hindu-Buddhist interface and looking at things like Machendranath and Kumari for that reason, but above all Kumari, because she was female. And that also underpins my later research in Ireland again, into young girls having visions of the Blessed Virgin. So, yeah. Perhaps I'm jumping ahead of myself too much.
Not at all. But your first exploration of Central Asia and the Himalayas was in the 50s, I take it. When was it that you actually returned to Nepal to conduct research here?
1967.
Enormous changes had taken place in Nepal,
yes,
during that time.
Yes.
Had you maintained contact with the country at all, or with people you'd met here?
Just the odd letter to two friends, Luchi out here, Pramod Shamshirjung, Baharurana in these tumble-down palace opposite the King's Palace, who I was just having breakfast with this morning. Yes. Well, there's been correspondence.
And what was the constellation of factors that did bring you back to Nepal? Was it an opening up of research possibility
in Australia? Yes,
that's right.
Yes, the whole thing begun to very much change, first and foremost in Southeast Asia, but it became possible really to do research by the late 60s, wherever.
Had you become pretty quickly a part of the anthropological establishment?
It was extraordinarily good time. I say Elkin told me, you know, that story. Yeah. But by the time I had my PhD in 1962, there were new universities just beginning, Macquarie University in Sydney, Monash in Melbourne, and a bit later there were other ones in within the next 5 years, mushrooming as all over the world, I suppose, yes. And they all wanted anthropology, so suddenly there was a huge marketplace for undergraduate teaching of anthropology. So you might say I hit the jackpot in terms of there I was at the PhD, so I got a job instantly at Sydney University for just 1 year as a temporary tutor, and then lectureship was advertised and I got it.
And you didn't think of maybe trying your luck back in the old world?
Yes, I did, and I'm really glad I failed to get it too. I applied for a job at Queen's University in Belfast just a few years before things really blew up in Londonderry and things got nasty. So I was very glad somebody else got that job. And by then I'd married an Australian woman and started to have Australian children. You know, my roots were sinking, developing and spreading through friendships, colleagues, and above all, family.
Did you take citizenship, or how did that go?
Eventually, only about 5 years ago. But you can take dual citizenship, so I remain Irish as well.
Did the family become part of your research agenda?
In Nepal, yes.
Wife and children to the field?
Well, in 1967, there was just one daughter. She was only one year of age. Probably a bit of a misadventure. She was a bit too young in many ways. There were quite a lot of problems. well, first of all, she had 6 months in Ireland. And there were all kinds of problems there with my mother too, and my mother hissing as my wife. But they arrived here, yeah, and in the height of, you know, April, the temperature really beginning to boil. Within 1 month, the poor little girl, she was just beginning to learn to walk. She fell off a wall up there in Kimdor into a great mountain of nettles about this high. She nearly died, and that was pretty horrendous. But she was there all that year, and then I came back in 72. There was a second daughter, who was then, what age she was? 68, yeah. So she was better, much better age. And Kerry, of course, then was older. We were here for nearly a year then, and then again in 78 for this part of a year, and all three of them were there, running up then into their early teens. So yes, and my wife, I've always, my ex-wife, should I say, but still a very good friend. We've had a family life here, actually, at Kimdor. In fact, the house now that is the Scoot Maitri Shishu, we were the first occupants of it. He built it initially for us, in fact. And then my wife started a little school for my three daughters in that last year, and that gave him the idea of having a school.
I see.
So it's very emotive when I go back to that house in all sorts of ways. Because it was a family house quite a long time, and Nucci's such an old friend, and now to see him teetering on at the edge of death, it's a very emotive visit, this, for me, in all sorts of ways. One, getting that manuscript, and two, I feel cycles turning themselves. That's the first time in my life I've begun to feel a bit old.
Interesting. Well, also that you've managed to juggle different and competing research agendas over these years, that it wasn't binary on or off, you know, Vanuatu and then Nepal, but these things have overlapped and probably
always
informed each other.
Yes,
as well.
And informed each other, yeah. The nearest time. I've never explicitly compared, in one article I never actually published, where I do compare different notions of virginity in the Pacific and here and in Ireland. I first gave us a seminar paper at Trevithan University about 4 or 5 years ago. No, 7 years ago. So it's been cooking still, and I'm still tinkering with it. But I did publish a collection of papers, Manohar, about 5 years ago, and the five papers on Pacific research, five here, and two long chapters on the Blessed Virgin and visionary stuff in Ireland.
Did the Irish research come later for you? Was that
yes.
A desire to return to the country in which you grew up, and also...
For a long time I had that kind of ambition that I'd love to. And it seems to me that, well, now it's commonplace, but in the early 80s it was not really commonplace for... I mean, there was still very much focus on the other in anthropology, and very little research being carried out by anthropologists in something like, much less directly, their own society. I always felt I'd love to do research in Ireland. For a long time I had thought of actually working with the gypsies, the tinkers, the travelling folk. But, well, somebody else started to do it well, and it just seemed to me overwhelmingly difficult. It's become such a huge crisis, and the parallels it's so awful, the life that they live. It's even worse in many ways than the Aborigines in Australia. And I just didn't feel I could handle it any longer. And I was thinking about this at the age of about 50. What triggered it off was in 1984, at the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald, a report, "Had the Irish finally gone off their rockers?" Words to that effect. And it was the first report of large numbers, tens of thousands of Dubliners and from one of the cities, from Belfast too, pouring into the countryside, claiming that they could see statues of the Blessed Virgin movement. I thought this sounds very good. That happens elsewhere, but in Ireland it had never happened, and the Irish like going to witness such miraculous events or get a feel of it in Lourdes. But there's, with only one exception, there's no visionary site in Ireland. And that, actually, I disposed of it myself along with the Jewish philosopher at Trinity College Dublin. It's a total fraud. What's it called? lock about 1880. So, I mean, it's not just in the Irish tradition. It struck me that something very odd is indeed going on in Irish Catholicism. Not just that you've got, but this is a mass phenomenon. And all the press were there, and the whole of Dublin daily was agog. All kinds of middle-class people were rushing out, and they were claiming in surveys of buses that 90% of each busload could swear that they could see this statue moving, though what they actually, how they interpret another matter. Well, that made me immediately get my pen out and start applying for an ARC grant. And to my utter amazement, I managed to get a fairly substantial one. And so I went off there in 1988, and spent a full year, and then again 1992, and frequent short visits ever since.
Was it for you a homecoming, or was it in a way an anthropology of a country which you had a fondness for but had never felt quite part of? Also, yes. So the religious component, I mean, it was precisely what you weren't in Ireland, wasn't
That's
it?
That's right, yes.
It must have been an interesting and somewhat ambiguous role.
It was, yes, and it's not only ambiguous for me, but it was ambiguous for the people I was working with. Because immediately of course I explained very quickly my background, but sometimes, you know, somebody I just met casually at a grotto in the big crowd started talking to them, they wouldn't know, I'd got to the point of explaining anything about what I was. They'd know like a flash that I was a Dubliner, even despite my 40 years in Australia. So then, there was ambiguity on both sides. Amongst those I got to know well, the particular visionary, in fact, the major visionary was the waitress at the time, at the hotel I was staying in, and that's why I stayed in it, because it was the center of one of the most intriguing of all the cults. So I was right in the thick of it, and very quickly I became very close friends with all of that family. And the most difficult thing I had, I think, of all, was they were full of great aspirations and hope. They were complete believers, and the whole family, they had two members of their family were actual visionaries. That I would become a believer, one of the biggest triumphs of all would be.
Of course.
And I explained that not only was I a Protestant, but I was not even a Christian, that I had become a non-believer, not disliker, but a non-believer, just somebody fascinated in religion, in all religions, and so on. For somebody like me to believe would have been, there was a great desire and also a concern, a sort of friendship concern, that how can this, I don't think they saw me as a nice bloke, be so mistaken. And that was fairly difficult to handle. Not to the point of distress or anything like that, but I did find, you know, that I used to go then with groups of Irish pilgrims to areas on the continent that they'd all been to, above all Medjugorje in Bosnia. I think about two-thirds of the Irish Republic between 1983 and still now, they're still going in vast flocks to Medjugorje. Something like 40 million, according to some calculations, others 25 million, not Irish, but Catholics all over the world, have been to Medjugorje, another major visionary site. So I started going with little Irish groups of believers, and one occasion with the young girl who was then about 12, 13, who was regularly serving me breakfast and who was still having visions. That's not quite correct. She was having what they call inner locutions, getting messages in her head from Our Lady, where she had been having major visions, and she was really being sent by a family to Medjugorje in the hope that the visionary stuff would come back again. But actually, it was the turning point. She's now an IT technician, married to a Belgian in Brussels.
Have you followed over the years the growth in the Sai Baba followings in India and Nepal, of course? I mean, it's even penetrated Kathmandu now.
Sai Baba, his portrait is over my bed up there.
Do you start seeing parallels and sort of constellations of belief coming together? Because to be able to draw based on field work in Ireland, back into Nepal, from Nepal, I suppose, to Vanuatu?
Yes, of course, indeed. I'm still puzzling what to do with it, but the global aspect is enormous. It has to be with Catholicism. What has made it more, in a sense, globally now, I suppose, is just the modernization of Ireland, the sudden effervescence, the fact that so many now have the money to go regularly every year to Lourdes, to Fatima, they go to one of the visionaries, a woman now of about 40, actually. She's forever being asked to go around the Caribbean or to the Philippines on lecture tours, financed by wealthy Catholics in these areas. The way she described going on a luxury cruise through the Caribbean, and the main entertainment for all the wealthy tourists in the evening was listening to her talk about visionary stuff.
The global conference circuit.
Yes, that's right.
Interesting. Did your family also accompany you back to Ireland in the 80s, or were the children grown up by then?
Yes and no. They came over with me on the first occasion, just for a short time. But they were all engaged in other things. They couldn't stay very long. But they're all going themselves individually, frequently.
So the Irish identity is definitely part of their lives as well.
Oh, very much so. Absolutely. Yes, they have very strong Australian accents. They're certainly they're like holding the Irish passport, both for sentimental and practical reasons, because it gives them access to jobs throughout the EU. Two of my daughters have had jobs, you know, on that basis.
Yeah. One of the aspects I was wondering about, I suppose, is that of Nepal. When you come here as a scholar, there's been a large American involvement, of course, in Nepal in terms of scholarship, and a large European one. But in terms of, one doesn't immediately think of Australia very often as a country that's produced many researchers of Nepal. Present yourself as an Australian scholar? Or an Irish one, or a combination thereof?
I mean,
do you?
I suppose more Australian in recent years, yes. Mm-hmm. To begin with, up to about 30 years ago, Irish, yes. And especially anywhere in Asia. Because I think the Irish, you know, there's a sentimental affection for the Irish, especially in any part of the ex-British Empire, and especially in India or Pakistan. I find it easier to make friends or to be accepted in some way, to be Irish. Australia, indifferent one way or another, to be British was... since I sounded British, I've made clear that I was not British.
Could you talk a little about
that? That wasn't so in Nepal, of course. Colonized.
Sure. Could you tell us a little bit about, I suppose, your early years of fieldwork in Nepal and the kinds of people you were meeting, both, you know, local and also international, the research topics that were being discussed? Because one has a strong sense of schools of anthropology, which I'd like to ask about later, perhaps.
Yeah.
The, you know, French school and a British school, and also an American school. And those, Nepal is a perfect example to see those, those disciplinary concerns played out. I suppose, in that respect, you were free of affiliation. You were not being asked by professors who had been working in Nepal before to pursue research in a certain way. Perhaps you could talk a bit about the people you met and your research interests here.
Well, first of all, foreigners. I met foreign researchers, and especially in the 60s, they were as rare as dog's teeth. I mean, I didn't meet many, or if they were around, I didn't know about them.
Did you meet David Snodgrove and Christoph und Wilhelm Heimendorf, or?
In London.
Not here.
But not here, no.
I see.
No. I don't think he, even by 67, I don't know when he last came here, so a very, very long time ago. Mm. I remember talking to him. I went to London before I first came here in 67 to try to learn Newari. But when I got there was no Newari being taught. Nepali. So that was a bit of a frustration. But yes, I saw quite a bit of Fjörður Heimendorf and Snellgrove then, and talked about their work with them. And I suppose I was feeling myself very much as initially as following on from Führerheim, but I wanted to further explore into what he called the elements of Newa social organization. Though I really hadn't much idea what direction to go. And at the beginning, there was quite a bit of literature, especially Indian anthropology, on sacred centers. Swayambhu, that's where I first lived, and clearly is a fascinating place. I thought I initially might begin to focus on it as a sacred place and try and unravel some of the immense historical and cultural complexities that are involved in that place. And also because my friend Nucci also lived up there, so it was going to be residentially very handy. I spent a lot of time there at Swayam, more often than not sitting in the grass and looking at monkeys and working out their social organization. I was so utterly confused, and I knew I was never going to, apart from the difficulties in Newari, I was never going to learn Tibetan, and I wasn't all that interested anyway in what they were doing. Go in and hear them chanting, I quickly get bored and whatever. But then I began to discover the Newa community up there, that sub-branch of the Bhadracharya, I forget now what they were called. They are full Bhadracharyas, the Puruvits who carry out all the daily rituals. There's all the Newa families, in fact, up there that in turn do their duty. So I started observing all their rituals and making contact with a number of individuals, a man called Samakai up there, who's long, long since dead. He became a wonderful informant in Newa rituals, but the rituals they did up there. But then that opened my eyes to the fact that this was just one tiny bit of a vast of a Bahabahi organization. So I went back and checked the Führer Heimendorf stuff, and sure enough, he had some rudiments about it. So then my attention switched very much to that in part. And though I didn't, because I all my established the family in a nice house over there, I didn't upheave, you know, and go to part, which I probably should have done, but it meant an enormous amount of traveling backwards and forwards, and very much working through a few individuals that I'd make arrangements with to meet rather than. So I was not getting classical anthropological material of day-to-day life, the way David Gellner subsequently did. But it was a bit like Hemraj Sakya. I had long, and many of them from him, long lists of Bahas and Bahis and the Kacha Bahas, and then beginning to do censuses of them and genealogies and of a few key ones like Ho Baha and Vinci Baha and so on, about half a dozen, and Kwa Baha as well. And began to build up a reasonable notion of some of the elements of the internal organization of this and the kind of rituals that they were carrying out. And that then led to the next stage, I thought, to look at some particular cults in greater detail. First, Machendranath, though I've never really published anything very much on it. Father Locke took over there, and I thought, well, I'll leave that to him. And Kumari, yes. But throughout, I never had much contact with other anthropologists.
Did you?
In conferences, I'd meet them, you know, when I wasn't here, at Madison and places like that, or in London. It's partly because I suppose I was living a family life too, and when I wasn't, sure. and this fractured nature of fieldwork of kind of, you might say, taxi anthropology almost.
Yes. And also because I suppose much Himalayan anthropology was defined by the idea of the village, where you go and you don't come back until you're finished.
Yes, and that's exactly, of course, what I did initially, and was a very much floundering how to handle a culture in this spread eagle sort of manner all over the place.
Absolutely. Was language and learning Nepal Bhasa, or previously known as Newari, an important element for you? Was that an entry point to penetrating the culture, or did you work with people who spoke Nepali as well and English?
Partly being deaf, also tone deaf, also, as Nucci would say, "Oh, Michael, you're useless. I tell you 10 words today and tomorrow you've forgotten eight." I am absolutely hopeless with languages, no question about it. I was reasonably fluent 20 years ago in Nepali, but Newari I could never even begin to I could, you know, pick up the drift of the topic at the most, but no way could I articulate it. Well, I did not work in Newari, so I always had to use an interpreter, somebody who did speak Nepali as well, or even better, English. And I must say, Nucci was 9/10 of the time I was with him as interpreter. So it was very much, not that I wanted it, I'd given my right arm to have learnt Newari, but I knew I never would. So it was Margaret Mead type of anthropology in many ways. And that's another reason too. I mean, I gave you one reason why I went to Ireland, but another reason was, I was aware then of an early contact with David, and it became apparent that he was doing the very things that I wanted to do if I'd only speak. Right, let's get out of this. There are other people around who can do it far better.
Your contact with Nepal, of course, and with friends here has endured, and yes. Described that this is, of course, a very emotional and personal visit as well as a professional one. Yes. Has there been the case also for Vanuatu? Have you returned there? Do you have ongoing relationships?
Yes, very much. I was there only last year.
And
every few years I'll be back there. And, mostly now just to see friends. Mm. And adding to the sense of transformation.
Hmm. Yes, I was going to ask about the social change. I remember in an interview that Professor Alan McFarlane did with Andrew Heimerdorf. Heimerdorf says at a certain point, all these young people are coming to Nepal these days, and they all want to study social change. Hmm. How can they do that if they've never been there before? And of course, but you have precisely the historical perspective to shed some light on these things. What have you seen as the great transformations of the Kathmandu Valley where you spent so much time?
Well, it's just totally obvious. The huge change is the demographic one, and all the complex consequences from the huge flood of people into the valley from, I don't know, it was certainly less than 1 million in the valley in the early 60s and late 60s. Forget what the figure was, maybe about 800,000 or something. What is it now? Over 5 million, I think? In this tiny space, and all the things that go with that, the disappearance of 3/4 or 2/3 of the rice fields into brick kilns or buildings. When I first came here, there were only 6 Model T Fords. There's now a multitude of vehicles belching out fumes.
Was Kimdall, in a way, outside of Kathmandu when you were first?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Well, the Changni was a lovely open, it was common land, you know, for grazing. You've got goats grazing on it. The army just slowly, they had a little bit of it, but they just gobbled it up bit by bit by bit, right up now to the whole lot, virtually, in varying way. Well, not virtually, absolutely. Apart from some parts, some very wealthy individuals managed to get hold of them. And it's not, when I go around the side of Swayambhu and look towards Balachu, that was a long, long, beautiful stretch of country. It's all 3 or 4 story houses everywhere. So that's the most obvious, and with it, the fact that it's so much more a mixed community, because a huge amount of that increase has been people from non-Newa people from outside. There have always been, of course, non-Newa people here, but obviously the Newas must have greatly declined as a percentage of the population. But change is one thing, I found myself always fascinated with continuities. I went yesterday to Indrashastra, probably the 9th time I think I've been there, or something like that. And it's changing hugely, quite clearly. Above all, it's changing as a state theatre. It's becoming more and more a state demonstration of its grandeur, its power. And when the king comes out on the balcony, in the past it would have been mainly civilians, politicians, important dignitaries, maybe the odd poet. Now it's about 2/3 army, colonels and generals and field marshals laden with medals, and a sprinkling of the ambassadors. It is, and waiting for the big event, the amount of army came in, the huge trucks piling out all over the place. Not always looking very sinister, but really a kind of theatrical show, and with the bands playing and everything else. That side of it is enormously multiplied. But the core of it all is absolutely identical, you know, and everything to do with the Kumari and Sawar and Baku and Ganesh dancing round, the general crowd behaviour, it's as if always. So it's, yeah, and it's, I think most especially the Newars have an extraordinary determination to retain identity, perhaps accentuated in fact by the fact that so many non-Newars all around them, a lot of rituals have been carried out now probably in a technically more correct and full way than they would have been 40 years ago. There are more experts around, there are more determination to do it right.
On the topic of the Kumari, of course, the very concept, the idea has captured the imagination of many, you know, a jurist, a filmmaker, a writer. Have you become part of, in a way, the production of general knowledge also on the Kumari, and do you see your work being invoked by people who like to talk about it?
Yes, I mean, I'm endlessly in journal articles, not academic, you know, popular articles, especially here, newspaper articles, and some of the misquotations or whatever, or misuse, or even just embarrassment over what I said myself that was correct. correct, that's what I said, wouldn't say now. Yes, it obviously has been. Because it's gone into three editions. For a long time, it was about the only significant publication at all on Kumari. But it still isn't, apart from the fascinating new book that the next Kumari has just written. And there is another one, though, on the way. A man called John Mellership, another Australian. He's a very weird kind of character, a very independent scholar. Very difficult to categorize. What he is, or what's going to be in his book on Kumari, but he informed me just a while ago that it's about to go into press.
Do you visit with ex-Kumaris who you've known over the years, as well as that part of also your circuit of visits and friendship here in Kathmandu?
Yeah, not so much in Kathmandu, but yesterday I went back to them. The Kumari I've had the longest connection with, the one most intimate knowledge of, is the Parton. What was the Parton Kumari, but she still is. And that, it, in a way. And I went to her house, which is the same house of the official Kumari in Parton at the moment. It's her niece who's the official Kumari, age 10. And this one that I first knew, when she was, I suppose, about 10, she's now 50. And her face is identical, almost identical, partly through makeup and partly because it's so sad. I mean, she's so absolutely childlike. She never goes out of the house, even at 50 now, other than on those few occasions at the Kumari, and she still goes out on the official occasions, even though she is in the background. So that was quite extraordinary, and the only other member of the family, and to make it even more weird, the whole house was being reconstructed, and I said, we had to battle our way through bits of corrugated iron and over bricks, and I put my hands on the banisters and took them out, all covered in paint. And in the middle of it all, in a tiny little room, the only room that was hadn't been knocked down, on a bench like this, in comes. She's now so fat. Sitting here, and then the other end, the little new one. And then I was plonked in the middle, and cameras were clicked. And it was very, very weird indeed. It made me very sad, actually. There's an issue that one of the things that I've perhaps been most criticized locally over is, well, it was actually a misinterpretation of what I was saying, but representing some beliefs about ex-Kumaris and difficulties they face in life, as though I was saying that indeed they do face these difficulties, which in fact sometimes they do. But the beliefs are often very exaggerated, such as husbands are regularly falling dead because of the lingering power of the Devi within our own. They made a mistake doing the puja or something of that kind. Those things obviously are largely nonsensical. In fact, this autobiography, Rashmila, is very much intended to try to counteract those misapprehensions. But the beliefs certainly are, and in many ways, you know, the Patan Kumari, it's not only the beliefs, it does seem to me to have wound up in a particularly tragic life. She's never been educated at all. Now, of course, the younger one, yes, she has, from the state, she has a tutor who comes in and teaching her quite a lot, and she even knew a few words of English. But she's almost done, the older one. She can scarcely, yesterday was the first time I've ever heard her speak. And it was just a few words. And to add to it, her brother, who's a very, very talented painter, art painter, I've got some beautiful paintings of his at home. He's been dumb from birth. He can't speak at all. So you get one who's been rendered dumb by culture, and the other dumb by nature. It is just, yeah. Well, you're asking, do I visit that family? I have visited again and again and again whenever I come to Nepal. And I feel now, I always felt happy enough when the mother was alive, and it didn't seem too sad a situation, especially when she actually was a Kumari. But now I feel almost guilty going there, because in some ways my devotion is, as it would be seen, because I do go through the honorifics and whatever, make offerings, must be a factor in perpetuating what now seems to be a very tragic scenario. Anyway.